Welcome to the Spoolcast. Steven Anderson joins Jared Spool in a discussion about data visualization. Steven will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 19 conference October 27th through 29th in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. And now, here's Jared.
Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of the Spoolcast. And I got to tell you, this is going to be a lot of fun today because we have the amazing Stephen P. Anderson with us. And Stephen last year gave a topic on sort of rethinking the way you communicate the data in your applications in such a way to be more engaging and more exciting. And he just blew away the audience. I mean, he was just a big hit for the day, and we were so excited to have him there. And we have been crazy enough to invite him back for this year for UI19, which is going to be October 27th through 29th. And he's going to do the same workshop, except a year better. And I'm very excited about that. And so we're going to talk about that today. Hey, Stephen, how are you?
Doing great. How are you, Jared?
I'm doing fabulous. So last year when you did this workshop, it was practically the first time you'd ever done it. And no one had been talking about this stuff. And it really sort of changed the way we thought about how we present all this stuff in our apps and how we get users to interact with that data and the sort of core content that is in a lot of the applications and designs we come up with. And in that year, you've been really studying this, right? And talking to people about it and doing more workshops and working with clients. And has anything changed? Has stuff crystallized in your head about this topic?
Oh, yes, quite a bit. There have been several things that have really helped a lot of the ideas that, you know, even as useful and practical as the workshop last year was, some things have crystallized and gotten a lot less fuzzy for me. And at least a couple things in there. One, I did an iteration of this workshop at the IA Summit conference, and I really knew that I needed to disrupt it and disrupt my thinking in some fundamental way. And also, I'm learning a lot more about this whole topic of how humans come to understand things. And so I invited Carl Fast to join me on the workshop just because I needed something to change the flow, change the activities, all that, and deepen my own knowledge. Carl Fast is, of course, a professor at Kent State University, where he's been teaching and speaking and researching all things UX, but especially around data visualization, data interaction for coming up on a decade. And so that was a big catalyst in just the conversations that we had. And then at the same time, I've been working on my book, which is Designing for Understanding, which will come out next year. And as I'm writing through the chapters and doing the research, a lot of the ideas that have been fuzzy in the past, which, as you know, you can kind of get away with some inspiration in the talk, but when you sit down to write a chapter or do a longer workshop, you really have to have your thoughts be crystal clear. And so there are some thoughts that since the summit have really crystallized for me, and particularly some basic thoughts around talking about these understanding problems. And then once we know how to talk about these, what happens next? Probably the biggest change is, I think in previous years, I would open with lots of examples of understanding problems that we're surrounded by. So one I used in a TEDx talk was about my son's diabetes chart, his medical form, and just how broken that was. Other ones I've used are more what we think of when we talk about visualization. So shopping for health insurance, for example, or shopping for a digital camera. So I talk about these breadth of examples, but then in the afternoon, I was kind of aware of it, even though I couldn't put, you know, the right language around it. A lot of the activities centered around one of those visualization problems, one where you have lots of things that you're comparing, like the digital camera, the health insurance options. And I realized I was neglecting these other kinds of understanding problems. And so that really set me down the path of trying to explore what are some names or labels that we can use.
So when you say understanding problems, you're talking about things we have in our design where in order for the user to get the most out of the experience, they have to understand some pretty sophisticated stuff.
Yes, absolutely. And sophisticated or simple. There are simple examples, like this is actually one that's really popular with a lot of graphic designers. Redesigning the airline boarding pass.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and then, of course, complicated ones being data viz, and you hear about the Internet of Things and how we have, you know, trillions of pieces of data collected, you know, every second about us, right? Or whatever the numbers are, and how do we make sense of those? So it's all of the above. And I think the data collection is one half, but then the sense making or the understanding part is the other half that, you know, for good reason, isn't talked about a lot right now, but which is becoming the most important focus, which, you know, I have all this data. Now what? What do I do with it?
So when you were talking about the understanding problems getting broader for you, what are some examples of understanding problems that you sort of missed that first time?
Yeah, well, I think I was covering the examples. What I had not done was really call out explicitly or name them, like where are the boundaries or where are the centers for these different types of understanding problems. And I think, you know, if you look at whether it's change management or any type of problem solution approach, you kind of have to name or label the problem to begin with. And so what I said about doing was saying, okay, let's name or let's label or classify, if you will, all these understanding problems so that then I can go through each and say, okay, well, what's the best way? What are the best skills to have to respond to each of these? And so I kind of came up with 7 problems of understanding. And my hope is that by at least labeling and identifying these, we're better oriented to know how to respond or what skills to use to respond to these. And this is very different from what you see in industry today, where people are still talking about data visualization problems or information visualization problems or, you know, information design problems. And I think that's maybe the wrong way to go about it because it's defining the solution ahead of time. But the moment you say this is a data viz problem, you've already defined the solution. And maybe it's not a data viz problem.
So if it's not a data viz problem, what is it?
If you'll indulge me, I'll run through the 7 problems of understanding.
Okay.
Yeah, just really quickly. So I mentioned the boarding pass as an example, and that's just Google like redesigned boarding passes. You'll see lots of graphic designers who've done that. If you remember a few years ago, the Target prescription bottle, medicine bottle, that redesign changed the experience, right, of that moment when you're interacting with your prescription pill bottle. Really small example, a very small data problem.
So that was a pill bottle that actually a student did.
Mm-hmm. Deborah Adler.
Yep. And she had been working with the folks at Target, and they loved it so much, they actually put it into production. And really what it did was it solved some basic problems, particularly for people who had vision problems, who had lots of medications. So she was mostly concerned, if I remember correctly, about her grandmother and her grandfather, who, when she opened their medicine cabinet, had all these medications that looked identical, and they couldn't figure out whose medications was whose. So they did simple things like using colored rings to say, this is grandma's medication versus this is grandpa's medication. And then making the print bigger and making the dosage more obvious and stuff that no one had considered before.
Yep, really simple changes, but simple changes that had a dramatic effect on just understanding. Like, I think some of the problems that drove Deborah to create that were, you know, I think some problems of taking the wrong bottle, which is actually quite common, I think, for everyone. But I think in her case, she noticed it with her grandma or her grandmother taking the wrong prescription bottle. And so that classification of problems, I would call problems of comprehension, where all the information's there, and it's not very much. It's just not been presented in a way where it's easy to understand, easy to know what to do or what to do next in the case of the boarding pass. The nutrition labels are an example of this as well, where, you know, people are always redesigning or trying to figure out how to redesign a better nutrition label. That one's tricky in that there's not one better solution because our dietary needs are so different. So I think that one, when we talk about solutions to the nutrition label, is going to require some kind of interaction or digital interface. We can talk about that if you want. But it's still a problem of comprehension where there's a very small set of information that's just not been presented in a way that's easy to understand. So that's type one. The second type of understanding problem would be probably the one that I've harped on because I've seen the fewest people talk about it. And that's the problem of comparison, where you have a lot of options to choose from, usually dozens, maybe hundreds. So definitely I'd put it in the category of a small data problem, but the way the options are presented just doesn't help you make a decision. So the end goal of a problem of comparison is to make a choice or narrow your options. And that would include the health insurance plan, you know, shopping for a new TV, picking a doctor, finding a mechanic to fix your car, all those types of things. Even at the IA Summit, the workshop activity we did was choosing a UX conference to attend, because I think there's what's clocking in over 500, 600 UX conferences in a year nowadays. And how do you find, you know, the very best ones like UI19? And so we actually created, or the goal was to create an interface that would help people make comparisons, and not just based on the content and the workshop itself, but also rolling in things like, how far is this from me? How much will my travel costs be? What are the hotels in the area? Things like that. That's a problem of comparison. So that's the second type. The third type would be, bear with me on this one, it's a little bit different. This one took a while for me to articulate, but I'm calling it problems of causal relationships. And if you've followed any of the stuff that Brett Victor's done, where he's shown essentially simulations for math, for example, or he's talked about how programming should have more of a tight feedback loop, where as soon as you program, you're seeing changes. These are problems of causal relationships.
So it could be as simple as adding to the checkout process, put your zip code here and we'll tell you the sales tax and the shipping cost.
It is that, although that, I think if it's really small and one-dimensional like that, I would call that a feedback loop, but it's when the feedback loops are spread over time. Like, you want to learn a math concept. By playing with a simulation and interacting with it, you see hundreds of tiny feedback loops. And so you see that cause and effect over time that reveals patterns. That would be the difference there.
Okay, so maybe see if I understand this. I've been working lately because I've got this project that's happening in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and we've been inviting people to come and move to Chattanooga. They have to figure out whether, you know, they can afford to do that. So we've been playing with these cost of living calculators where they put in all these different factors and then they see if, you know, where they live in Brooklyn and then what it's like in Chattanooga, what's the relative salary, what's the relative cost, all this stuff. And there's a lot of sort of playing with things. Well, what if I do this? What if I do that? And it's very much a tweaking causal stuff. That sort of calculator, I would think, is a simple form of this. And then the math exercises, you know, there's a program that one of my kids is loving called Kerbal Space Program, where you have to go out and build a space orbiter and then figure out if it can complete the mission. Like, you know, can it stop an asteroid from hitting the Earth? And there's all these causal relationships between the thrust of the engine that you put into the space orbiter and whether it can maneuver finely enough to be able to catch the asteroid.
That is a perfect example. In fact, a lot of the examples I come up with are education related, where you learn through those interactions and that constant, frequent feedback loop.
Yeah, don't tell my kid this is education related. He's still thinking it's a game.
I would put Minecraft in the same category.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, don't tell them. They'll freak out. It's like there's the fastest way to learn to hate a classic book is to get it assigned in school.
Exactly. Yep. You had mentioned calculators, and I would consider, for example, a mortgage calculator to be a crude form of this, where you go in and, you know, there's a set of five or six variables or numbers testing for, you know, everything from the cost of the house to how much you're going to put down to the APR you think you'll get. And it's through playing with that you actually get a sense of what you can actually afford. What will your monthly payment be? Or you could start, you know, backwards. Here's the monthly payment I can make, you know, how much house does that afford me? And that, even though it's very crude and small, that's a perfect example of the same type of causal relationship where through the interaction and through the play, you see the patterns and you basically get the understanding that you don't have if you have to enter the information, hit submit, wait a minute or seconds and get that back. You know, it's the difference between hitting the submit button 100 times versus just dragging a slider for a second.
I remember one of the first programming projects I ever had was back when I was working for Digital Equipment Corporation, was doing product configurators for salespeople for mini computers. And so these were machines that had thousands of options, but not all the options worked together and people wanted to know what it was going to cost them. And so figuring out, well, if I choose this option, then I can't have that option, but there's this other option and, oh, the price goes up $50. But if I do this other thing, it goes up, you know, $100, that sort of stuff.
Yep. That would fit as well. So going back to your question that kicked things off, you said, where does DataVis fit in? It would fit really well into the fourth type of problem of understanding that I've labeled, and that would be the problems of discovery. Because often with DataVis and pure DataVis, we're talking about cases where people don't know what question they want to be answered. And this is very different. Like in the workshop, I say, what's the question you want to have answered? And the previous three examples, we could identify a question to be answered. Like, you know, we want kids to learn about math, or we want to see what I can afford, or, you know, which medicine bottle is mine, right? With problems of discovery, you have some ideas or hunches, but you really don't know what you're going to learn. It really is data mining. It's really about looking for insights and patterns that you weren't anticipating. And so that's why I call this problems of discovery. And, you know, most of the examples are data viz, although there are some examples that we would not consider data viz, but definitely problems of discovery. And so if we go back to, what is it, 1850, maybe 54, I believe, John Snow created the cholera map, which was basically, you know, by today's standards, we'd call it an information visualization. But he basically mapped all of the deaths due to the cholera outbreak and mapped that, you know, where they took place. And he saw this pattern when he put them on the map that, wow, a lot of deaths seem to correlate with this particular well. And, you know, that well eventually was covered up, but he was able to see this discovery. He didn't know what to look for. And I think this preceded germ theory by about 6 or 7 years as well.
Right. Yeah, it did. It was one of the things that sort of really set that off.
Yep. So that's a problem of discovery. I think the problems of discovery we have nowadays are much more complex and require not just visual representations, but interactions. And so an example I mentioned in my book is DNA and genetics. I mean, where we're talking how long our genetic code is, but, you know, scientists are working away looking for patterns. And the tools they use and the tools that we as engineers and designers provide them or create with them in collaboration are going to make the huge difference in whether these geneticists are able to find the patterns they're looking for or not. And there's an example of a product called Pathline, where it was custom designed working with these scientists. And it was so much better than the off-the-shelf charting tools they had been using previously. In fact, there's a story when I was researching this where when they first shipped out Pathline, they were watching the scientists use it and they jumped up and got excited because they were seeing patterns they had never seen before because of this new tool, this new visualization and the new interaction possibilities. So that, you know, again, I think there's a huge role in discovery that product teams can play. And the more we know about these skills of, you know, visual representation, these skills of interaction and the data, you know, behind it, just the better prepared we are for, you know, this uncertain future where we have more of these discovery problems.
Well, I would think that a big piece of this is what's behind what people are doing with analytics and even the tools we create for ourselves, where we're trying to create analytics tools to understand what's happening in our own designs. The more toolkit capabilities we have, I don't know if you know this, we came out with this service we call All You Can Learn, and it's basically a video watching service. It's, you know, all those seminars and videos we've ever put live in this thing. And so we've been trying to understand internally at UIE, how are people using this, right? You know, when people come in and they watch videos, what happens? What led up to that point? What happens after that point? Do they watch a lot of videos in a burst? Are they binge watching? You know, we're trying to understand these things. And we found that the analytics tools that are out there, things like Google Analytics, really don't help us with that. And being able to do things like slice off really active users and see if their behaviors are different than the average user is really hard to do. And we've had to come up with our own visualization tools, and we're really struggling with this. So it sounds like this would help us a lot, coming up and being able to start pulling apart these basic things where we don't actually know what question we're trying to answer. We have some very vague ones, like, you know, if 2% of our audience are our most active user base, how do we get the next 2% to be more like them? Right?
Yep. This would definitely fit in there. In fact, analytics are curious because you can approach them as problems of discovery where you're looking for patterns that maybe you don't know. You can approach them as problems of, you know, comprehension, relationships, comparison. They can kind of fit on a lot of these depending on whether you have a question to be answered or not. That's the dividing line there. And analytics are, you know, you see some packages, they're designed to answer specific questions, but maybe they're not the questions you want answered. And so then you find yourself hacking it to, to answer the questions you're looking for, or they're complete, just abstract off the shelf data tools that don't really answer the question specifically. And so you got to figure out how to roll your own, or analytics in particular, really a curious entity. And yeah, rarely have I seen out of the box an analytics package that answered everything that the specific client app that I was working on needed to know.
Oh, I rarely see out of the box an analytics app that actually doesn't leave more questions than answers.
Yep. Or lead you to the wrong conclusions because there's missing information.
Oh, yeah. And it just implies things, right? You know, my favorite are sort of eye tracker heat maps that imply what users are looking at, when in fact, the eye tracker doesn't measure what users are looking at or what they see. You know, it measures where their eyes point, which it turns out, you know, doesn't take into account peripheral vision, doesn't take into account a lot of factors, doesn't take into account that I can stare on the shelf in my refrigerator for 5 minutes and still not find the ketchup that's sitting on that shelf.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, there's a problem right there.
Yeah, it's what my wife used to refer to as male refrigerator blindness.
Yep. I have children who can help me find my keys when they're gone. I have one particular child who has a knack for that. Like, I cannot find my keys. Can you find them for me, please?
This child will be very useful as the years go on. Do not get rid of this one. This is a keeper.
So these first four problems were pretty easy to identify. And then it was over a period of about a week. It happened pretty quickly that the final three kind of rolled in. And it was just really looking at some of the examples again and some of the things that I hadn't accounted for. And so the fifth one, I think, is something we're all familiar with. I would call it problems of relationships. But this is where there's really not things to be compared. There's not a lot of data necessarily. But anytime we go into a new space where there's a lot of learning going on, there's that, I think psychologists call it the initial schema formation, where you go in and you're just trying to get oriented to a space. So if mobile app design is new to you, the first time you go in there, you're just trying to separate what's the difference between this phrase progressive enhancement and responsive web and, you know, what are the mobile devices? And a quite common exercise here is to create a mind map, you know, these things with circles and lines. And what you're trying to do there is you're trying to orient yourself to the space. You're trying to see the relationships between the different topics so that you can then drill down and actually go deeper into a specific topic.
Now, these aren't necessarily causal relationships, right?
Just flat out relationships. How do things relate to another? And, you know, one is subordinate, one is a peer of, one is, you know, a parent of, you know, these types of things. So it's just orienting yourself to the space. And concept models, mind maps, are a perfect response to this problem of relationships. You know, in many ways, you could say a sitemap kind of solves a problem of relationship or attempts to solve that problem of relationships. How will these pages, you know, relate to each other? How will people navigate? So that would be the problem of relationship. Not a lot to talk about there, other than to acknowledge that, yep, that's a type of understanding problem that needs to be accounted for if this catalog I'm coming up with is going to be, you know, truly comprehensive. The other one that, again, not a lot to talk about here because there's not a lot you can do, I would call the problem of practice. And so I'll give a very personal example here. I recently, in the last year and a half, have gotten very into espresso drinks. I went to Italy, had my first taste of, you know, a good shot of espresso, and have come back and tried to learn all I can about this world.
Wow. I've never been able to like espresso. To me, it's just burnt beans.
That's what I thought until I went to Italy and I had my conversion experience there. I was in Rome and, you know, I think I have a text where I texted my wife and said, this is nothing like the black bitter swill we've been drinking at home. But, you know, there's a lot of head knowledge, you know, problems of comparison, for example, that you can read about or try to learn and you can understand. But ultimately, when it comes to pulling a really good shot or, you know, doing the latte art or all that, it's what I would call a problem of practice, where really you just got to sit down and practice if you want to get better at it. And so that's, you know, the understanding comes through the practice itself. And I think you've in the past used the example of, what was it, chicken sexting? And that would be a perfect example of this problem of practice.
Where identifying baby chicks before they're physically identifiable is an important thing as to whether they're male or female. And so there are people who just learn to do it. And the way they learn to do it is they just practice and practice and practice next to someone who's experienced. And every time they get it wrong, the experienced person basically tells them they got it wrong. And over time, they get it right. And if they just put in enough practice, they can learn to do it.
Yep. In fact, that example may make its way into my book because it's so perfect. It's something you can't be taught head knowledge. You just have to experience it and learn it and develop the skill.
Right. Yeah. So it sounds like a very Gladwellian 10,000 hours sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Understanding in this case comes through practice, and you can't really explain it or draw a diagram or let someone play with a simulation. They just have to jump in and do it.
So, you know, surgeons practice their sutures, and they just do that over and over and over again until the motor skills just happen. You know, baseball players learn to hit 95 mile per hour fastballs. And so it's basically just getting in there and doing it over and over. And we all do that, right? I mean, we just get better the more we do it. And we've had these conversations like, how'd you do that? I've just practiced a lot.
It's exactly it. More perfect examples. The final type of understanding problem, I saved it for the last just because it's the hardest to talk about. And it's like on the little model where I put all this together, it's the one that's, you know, the farthest to the right, most complex, you know, everything. It's what I'm calling the problem of distributed cognition. And so in this case, you know, fancy word, but in this case, basically what I'm saying is the knowledge you need for understanding is distributed across people, objects, environments, things like that. And it's, you know, this obviously ties back into service design when we're trying to connect all the pieces. But even if it's not just service design, getting different devices to talk to each other, this one shows up in lots of different ways. So I'll start with a kind of I'll give two examples. One would be, you know, the original project to map the human genome. And it was a project that took, I believe, nearly 15 years and originally initiated in 1987. And if you read about the history of mapping the human genome in this project, it was scientists working around the globe to try to, you know, map the 3.3 billion base pairs or something. And definitely there was a lot of knowledge. They had to get on kind of a similar framework or similar language so they could, you know, share their data and work together. So definitely it wasn't something that could be solved with one person using a better tool in the laboratory. It had to be, the knowledge had to be distributed. And there was actually, it's quite a interesting story if you get a chance to read about it. There was some competition there with a private company who was trying to be the first to map the human genome so they could patent it. So then any advances that came out, we would have to pay for. And so to keep it, you know, in a sense, open source and freely available to the public, there was kind of a time frame they were racing against.
Right, right. Not assign a huge price tag. You know, this is the old argument, right, of we're investing a lot of money to figure this out. We should be able to recoup our investment through licensing fees and competitive advantage versus the, hey, you know, humanity needs this. We need to make this cheap and easy so that so many interesting things can be built on top of it.
Exactly. Yep. And then, yeah, don't get me started on the ideology and political discussions there, because I definitely have strong opinions on that stuff.
We'll have another podcast.
We'll have another podcast on that. The other example, bring it back down to earth in a little more practical manner, is let's take a service like Uber.
Uber's the car summoning service that sort of competes with taxis in big cities.
Exactly. I like car summoning. And so the experience is you open up the app and you can actually see cars nearby that are available and ready to pick you up. And you can determine, are they close enough that it's worth doing this? You push the button, it requests the driver. The driver comes, you know, you get into the car, you tell them where you're going to go, and, you know, they drop you off, right? And even payment is handled passively then, because you've given Uber your credit card information. So, you know, when you get there, you just get out of the car. All in all, it's a pretty good experience, especially compared to the traditional ways that we hail a taxi cab. However, as good as it is, it's still broken at the seams. And so when I was using this at a recent conference with Carl Fast, who I mentioned earlier, Carl Fast had never used it before, and kind of having that uninitiated perspective, he was actually able to articulate some of the seams where the experience was broken, where cognition was in my head, but not in the driver's head, for example. And there were at least two cases here where the understanding hadn't been addressed. And one experience is as the car is approaching, you don't know which car is the car you've requested. And they give you a picture of the driver, which, you know, if the car is 30 feet away, you really can't see the driver's face. And they give you the make and model of the car and the license plate number. And so there's this stance that you have where you have the phone in your hand, which is kind of a signal to people that, hey, I am looking for the car, the specific car that is the Uber driver.
Yeah, and Uber drivers learn this signal. They can pick you off of the sidewalk because you've got the Uber stance.
Yes, exactly, the Uber stance. And you're looking at license plate, so you're kind of craning your head looking for this. So there's a case where there's knowledge, there's distributed cognition, like the person knows they're the car. You don't know they're the car. You're looking among these options. So how could you fix that broken seam? if you will.
Right. With UberX, right, which is, it's not always a black sedan, but it's their personal car. They don't even tell you what color. This is one of the things that I wish I had a picture of the car, because it just says Prius. And when you're in San Francisco, that's every third car.
Oh, gosh. Yep. Every other car.
But it doesn't tell you what color Prius even.
It reminds me of Lyft, which is a competitor to Uber, and they're known for the big pink mustaches that the drivers put on the front of their cars.
Right. And they've just launched a line of white sedans and SUVs to compete against Uber's black sedans. And they don't put the big pink mustache on front, but they have this mustache decal that goes on the grill that makes it very clear that this is a Lyft vehicle, but it's more classy. It fits in with the design.
Yep. So the second area where the seam is broken in this experience is, and actually one that I would love to see addressed, and we have the technology to do so now, and that is the moment you get into the car, you have in your head an understanding of where you want to go. And it may be an address. It may be just an area, like, you know, down by the harbor or whatever, right? Downtown. And you've got to get that knowledge into the head or the device of the person who's going to drive you there. And I can't tell you how many experiences I've had where basically I handed my phone to the person, or they gave me their phone and I typed in the address and handed it back. And when you talk about this great experience, this great service design, that's an area where it's actually breaking down. And so what I'm looking forward to are places where I can get into the car. I can have the address on my phone, for example, and I can just push it, you know, off of my glass and have their phone like accept it, right? The information. So the technology to do that is out there. If you look at, I think Scrabble is an example. If you look at the Scrabble for iOS, you can put an iPad as your Scrabble board in the middle, and different people can use their iOS devices to actually be their tile holders. So you still have that privacy. So the technology is here. It just hasn't been realized yet. There's another project that Josh Clark just shared with me called Magic Grab or Grab Magic.
Right. I've seen this. It's really cool.
Yeah. The guy just reaches out and he's watching TV and he grabs, he makes a gesture with his hand. He grabs. And at that moment, he's grabbing whatever is on the screen at that second. And he taps on his phone and that image appears as a screenshot on his phone. So you can grab whatever you see off the TV onto your phone.
And it's using a Kinect-like device. I think it actually uses a Kinect to capture the gesture for the grab off the TV. And then it uses the motion sensors on the phone to detect the put this on my phone.
Exactly. And that was actually done in 2012. And that was done as an evening hackathon project. And so if that could be done in, you know, 2 years ago, technology, and in an evening, you know, what can some of these, you know, companies working on the whole TV, you know, media, second screen experience actually do? How can we get our devices to talk to each other in a way that's seamless? I think this is a huge area where the knowledge can be passed, you know, not only between people and people and their device singular, but between devices plural. Exciting area to look forward to.
These seven things, right, these seven problems, as they were, that you can now come up with solutions for, having this taxonomy lets us understand how to prioritize our designs. I think this is brilliant, right? Because I think a lot of what we struggle with in the design world is not having words to explain how one thing is different from another. And then we get all muddled and confused. And I think you're working on a comparison problem, but you think you're working on a discovery problem. And because we don't have words to explain this, our designs just get crazy wacky and we're not working together. And so I see this as a tool that can really help teams ask themselves, you know, in this release, what would we like to do? In our five-year vision, what would we like to do? And actually break things down and have different answers for that, but all be on the same page all the time.
Yep. I mean, the better the language is for having this conversation, the more fruitful or constructive it's going to be. And it's not just the knowing the language, being able to identify it, but once you can do that, then you can decide, okay, what skills would be best to respond to this? So as a simple example, if, you know, it's redesigning a medical form, you don't have to get into a lot of, you know, heavy-handed interactions or, you know, coordination. It's just a simple chart with five pieces of information, seven pieces of information. So a simple visual makeover will do, right, in most of those cases. But if you move into something like the problem of discovery, at a minimum, you definitely have to think about the visual representation. You have to think about interactions because the data is so complex that you have to be able to manipulate and work with it So then you have this whole language around interactions and what are the types of interactions and what do they do cognitively. And, you know, in the case like the genome, for example, you probably got to think beyond just the tool and think about coordination across systems, across people, all of that. So now we can start to talk about representations as a response, interactions as a response.
Yeah, there's a service design element in there.
Yep. Through the lens of saying, okay, this is the problem I'm trying to solve, the understanding problem I'm trying to solve, we then are oriented to the skills that we need to respond to that problem. And I've been describing it like this. It's kind of like, I think a lot of workshops and courses on things like visualization or information design tend to approach it like a recipe. Like, we're going to give you the recipe and now you will know how to respond to this specific challenge. And of course, you go back and the very next challenge you get doesn't fit. It's not the same pattern, right? And what I'm likening this, the approach I'm taking is more like, instead of giving you a recipe where now you can make this one particular thing, I'm giving you, or I'm trying to provide skills that can help you in the kitchen. So we're going to go over knife skills. We're going to go over how to pair ingredients. We're going to go over the role of aromatics, right? We're going to go over, you know, to extend this cooking analogy, we're going to give you the skills that then you can apply to make whatever recipes you want to make, because you'll understand the fundamentals.
So this is moving past rule-based understanding to really being informed, and then you're going to need some sort of improvisational layer on top of that to be able to say, hey, what if we tried this? And everybody just knows what that means from their improvisational practice. And they do a yes and they move it forward. And you keep trying things until you get a solution that you're really thrilled with.
Yep. That's, I love the improvisation layer added to it. Yep, exactly. And you know me, Jared, everything I've tried to do is very much on the practical, like giving people skills they can walk away and use.
Yeah, it's one of the things I hate about you most.
You hate.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just like, oh, that's Steven Anderson. He's so damn practical.
You know, there's a degree of specificity that you can give someone that's you've overspecified. And that's really not a skill. It's a very, here's a way to respond to the specific problem if you ever have it. And so I'm always looking for those skills that are timeless and will apply in most cases. And I think that's been the hardest part in writing the book, is really keeping my eye on the timeless skills that we need to learn around understanding and not get sucked into these surface or superficial things that will, you know, are useful in their context, but don't scale across the whole variety of contexts that we have every day.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm really excited about this. I'm excited about the book, and I'm very excited about the workshop that you're going to be doing at UA19, because people are going to not only get a chance to learn this framework, but also practice it and make those decisions and start down their path of mastering how to use this to make really substantially better designs than they've ever done before.
That's the plan, hopefully.
It's great. I mean, it was highly rated last year at UI18. I heard nothing but amazing things from the people who saw you and Carl at the IA Summit. And I'm just so excited that you're coming back to do this for us at UI19.
Honored to be invited back. Thank you.
Oh, it's great. Well, Steven, thank you so much for sharing this framework with us today and talking about the 7 ways to tackle this stuff. It's really such fascinating stuff. We could do this for hours. Well, you're going to do it for hours at UI19, so that's good. I can't wait to be there.
I can't either. I tell you, every time this is reinvented, I get rejuvenated and excited. So I'm excited.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you sound reinvigorated. So that's good. That's good, because we needed to get more vigor into you.
You don't want a boring workshop leader.
Yeah. You know, espresso isn't the only way you become invigorated.
Yep.
Okay. Steven, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Jared.
And I want to thank our audience for taking the time to listen to us today. And I hope you'll consider coming and seeing Steven and the other great speakers we have at the User Interface Conference. You can find out more about it at uiconf.com. It'll be happening in Boston, October 27th through 29th. So that's all I got to talk to you about today. And I'm glad Steven came and glad you were listening. And thank you so much for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you next time. Take care.
For more information about Steven's and the other 7 workshops, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. As always, Thank you for listening.